Well, the world is a dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right, and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got Aaron Huey of the Beyond Risk and Back podcast and the Fire Mountain Residential Treatment Center. This is an amazing conversation that takes a lot of twists and turns, and it kind of comes in hot at an 11 and doesn't really let up. So strap in, grab a cup of coffee and probably a glass of water, because this is going to be a doozy of an episode. Doozy? Do I say doozy? Is that a word that I use? Somebody write to me and let me know if that's a word I've used before, because I don't feel like that's an authentic word for me. I'm not going to talk a lot at the beginning of this episode, but I did want to share something that's got me thinking. I've got a friend that I've been talking to just about every Tuesday morning now, and it's been really good. We sort of intellectually stimulate each other and get us thinking about different things. And he said something to me the other day that I don't know if it was meant to work my brain up or not, but he was talking about how he was looking for his keys. And when he found them, he had said that thing that we all say, which is, it's always the last place you look. And his daughter had interjected, of course it is. Why would you keep looking when you've already found them? And that really got my wheels turning. Why would you keep looking when you've already found what you're looking for? I think that might be a uniquely human thing. We do it all the time. We do it with relationships. We do it with food. We do it with our coping mechanisms. All the time, we are constantly moving past the things that we're looking for the next shiny object, for the new thing, whatever is on the horizon, because we're always looking to fill some sort of weird hole inside of us that's going to make us feel alive or beautiful or smart. What's the next thing? You've already found so many other things. So why are they not the thing anymore? Why are they not helping anymore? There's a lot of reasons for that. It can mean a lot of things. I mean, you're not going to fix a broken leg with ice cream the same way you would maybe mend a broken heart. You know what I mean? I don't know if you can mend a broken heart with ice cream either, but it sure as hell makes it feel better. You know, there's a lot to be said for looking past answers that you've already got because you don't like them, when you know deep down you've already found what you're looking for. If you're in a position where you know that you need help and you need assistance and everything that you've been trying to do has not worked for you so far, maybe you haven't found the right spot yet. Maybe you haven't. Maybe the answers are always in the last place you look. I don't know. What do you think? Hit me up. info@coffeeoversuicide.com. But I'm not going to waste any more time getting into this conversation with this nonsense up top. You can find Aaron Huey at firemountainprograms.com. He's also got a Beyond Risk and Back podcast. There's a Beyond Risk and Back app, B-R-A-B app. You can look that up. It's parenting resources for at-risk youth. There's a lot of great stuff in there. It's completely affordable, and it's definitely worth your time if you've got a teen that's struggling or if you're struggling to understand your teen. So get out there, check those things out, find him on Facebook, and find this conversation right now. Because here it is. My conversation with Aaron Huey. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. It's been a couple of months. It's been a hard couple of months.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What do you think is making these past couple of months so difficult?
Well, my answer is very clear. I'm very clear what's going on in these past couple of months. And we had really reached the top of our game in residential treatment for children. We were top referral. We had the number one results in the United States. We were called top 50 healthcare provider in the U.S., top 100 innovator of healthcare in the U.S. And we got a letter from our insurance company, property insurance, of all things. A liability in residential treatment is massive. But we got a letter from our property insurance saying that because of the fires in Colorado, our property insurance was going from $20,000 a year to $470,000 a year, and it ran us out of business.
Oh, my God.
And the Colorado Insurance Commission gave us shrugging shoulders. Politicians gave us shrugging shoulders. And the insurance company could give a crap. And my property is very, very safe. Fire roads, concrete siding, ponds, pumps. In tree line 150 yard away from my buildings. And they said, you have children living there. You're 400. Who can afford $500,000 a year in property insurance? That's not my liability. That's not my auto. That's my property. So we found that out. We got that letter at the beginning of August. And that was our 30-day notice. And on August 27th, after having five brokers working for us, we hit dead ends no matter which way we turned. So after, 2009, we opened the treatment center, the Sober Home for Kids, and grew into one of the top treatment centers in the U.S. and closed it down now 18 days ago. This past weekend was our estate sale. We were getting rid of art supplies and backpacks and everything like that. So it's been a journey these past couple months.
Talk to me a little bit about where people are supposed to go at this point.
County funded programs or extremely expensive ones. We had this nice middle ground where somebody working at a restaurant that had great insurance could do our program, right? We weren't a Malibu Beach program, and we weren't a county funded program. We were dead center, and like the middle class, those programs are disappearing. Either you have to turn your kid over to the county, or you've got $80,000 a month to spend on your child's treatment. And the in-betweens are being tossed aside. So where do you go? I guess my goal with my work now is to help parents keep their kids out of treatment. Because the treatment world is collapsing. The mental health for adolescents is collapsing in front of us. And so now the option we have is prevention. The option we have is teaching parents how to intervene in the crisis in their own families with little to no support. And so how do I become that little to no support? That's been my goal. That's been the pivot. The word has been frustrating during the pandemic because everybody in the world had to pivot. So this is not unique to me, but now it is, what did we do really well as an organization, which is create parent interventions. Our work with teens was great, but the work we did with parents is the reason we had the high success. So now it's, let's take this work. Let's make sure every parent has access to it. So that's our work now.
Yeah. Well, and especially now when it's so important.
Yeah.
Because the pandemic has done a lot of things. And one of the things that it's done is it's
it's created a pretty high level of anxiety in just about, you know, it seems like one in however many of whatever your group is, whatever demographic you find yourself in,
right.
there's going to be some anxiety involved in your day-to-day life. It doesn't matter what your politics are,
nope.
Where you come from, what your financial situation is. There's a level of stress and anxiety that's infecting just about everybody.
Age 13.
All of this change.
Yeah, age 13 to 17, it's 1 in 4. Like, yeah. 25% of teenagers are experiencing clinical level anxiety. That's astronomical. And the suicide rate among that age group is continuing to arise. Among the LGBTQA plus community is continuing to rise. It's the trickle down effect of every adult feeling like their safety has been compromised, right? The air you breathe, the people you love, they could kill you. If they hug you, if they touch you, if they're within 6 feet, it could kill you. Again, don't care about your politics. I had a guy say to me, rhinos and hippos. I don't care which side of the fence you're on. It's a rhino or it's a hippo. And I love that, because it doesn't matter. What matters is that whether you believe in it or not, whether you believe in vaccines or not, suddenly the feeling of safety in this world has been compromised for adults. Imagine the trickle down on the children. It's happening. And now that we're needed more than ever, insurance companies absolutely do not want to pay out. And now they're having to pay out even more. So they're trying to collapse the system from within.
I definitely want to get into that, but I want to go back a little farther. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved in the recovery business and in the treatment business. Like, what was it that struck you to get you this fired up about all this?
It was my 12th step. The idea of what it meant for me to take the message of hope to addicts who still struggled, to alcoholics that still suffered. I went through the steps beginning May 21st, 1998, was when I called the Triangle Club in Longmont, Colorado, and got an answer. I had called 2 weeks prior and got a busy signal, and I literally thought that was God telling me I could keep using. That's the insanity of addiction, so judge not lest ye be judged. But there it was. And so on May 22nd, 1998, I went to my first meeting. And the steps were awesome. The steps were powerful and potent. The steps were not the reason I got sober. I got sober because of the people walking me through the steps. The steps were secondary to the community that I had suddenly. The steps were secondary to the miracle of having three men tell me that they loved me in a 24-hour period, which was my miracle, which was my state of grace, moment of connection, intimate communion with divinity that made me say, this thing I've been looking for has been looking for me, and now I'm ready to let it in. Now, how that played out on this realm, the earthly realm, was when I got sober, the only job I had ever been sober at in the previous 7 years, I was an addict for 14. The 7 years I was a desperate addict and was high 24/7. But there was a job that I had working with kids in my last year of using and abusing and dependency. That was the only job I'd ever had that I never got high. I felt like it was a sacred space that while I was this camp counselor, I absolutely must not be high. But the moment I got in my truck to go home, I got high. And the man who ran the company, when I told him I was an addict, and he said, have you ever been high at work? I said, absolutely not, but there's certainly been drugs in my system, but I haven't been high around these children. His love, acceptance, and forgiveness was incredible. And a year later, I was promoted to be the assistant director of the company. It was within this work with kids that I started to recognize that I had a calling to help children who were experiencing a life like I had. My biological father, I never met. I was bullied mercilessly, and I was sexually assaulted as a kid. Sexual assault happened when I was 18. My first suicide ideation took place when I was 13 years old. And so all of those things had stacked up and led up to me using cannabis and LSD and alcohol as a maladaptive coping strategy that was just destroying my life. Yeah. So here I am sober, I'm working with kids, and I feel that pull. I feel that calling. And I especially feel a calling to help these parents who are going, what am I going to do about this kid? And working alongside the parents to intervene on the parents, not necessarily intervene on the kids. Intervening on kids is just keeping a constant state change and motivation going until there's a trait change. Because I'm not a therapist, so I can't do trait changes professionally. I can do state changes all damn day long with kids. And the difference is, you know, the state changes, if I tell you to stand up and give someone a high five and you smile, I've created a state change. And you just have to do that 1,000 times a day for 3 months straight. So here I am, I'm running, I've grown my own business. I've left this kid camp that I was working for, and I've started my own kids camps, very different from what I was working. And I started running teen rite of passage programs. And during this point, I also had a martial arts school. I was about 3-4 years sober, and things were going well. I was doing my work, I was doing my steps, and most importantly, I was every day 12-stepping. I was taking the message of hope and sobriety to people who still suffered. I was driving around Boulder, Colorado after phone calls on Friday nights and Saturday nights, picking up teenagers and taking them to meetings with me because they called me and said, I don't want to get high tonight. Can you take me to a meeting? And so I had a connection to the parents in my community that I was a guy that could go and pick up a kid and take him to a meeting and bring him home and then talk with the parents and debrief with the parents and mediate a conversation about addiction and suicide and the struggle, and to give parents a reality check about the difference between capability and willingness. Everybody's capable of a certain amount of things. Everybody's right. Willing of a certain amount of things. But if you say, oh, my kid's so depressed, they just need to get up and go volunteer at the Humane Society. Yeah, that's willingness. But depression is about capability. And if you're consequencing somebody's who is incapable, you know, anxiety is not about willingness to just deal with your fear. It's about capability. This is brain dysfunction. It's not a bad attitude. So helping parents navigate that conversation. I finally just had a parent call and say, can my kid just come live with you? And, you know, go to meetings with you, go to the gym in the morning, do your martial arts classes. They'll do school online and then just keep them safe at night. My wife and I said yes. And a week later we had 6 more and 4 boys on a wait list. And we were like, oh, this is what we're doing. 6 months later, I moved my own kids out of their childhood home. They sacrificed everything for this vision. And that all happened in 2009. So from 2009 until 18 days ago, we had been running one of the top adolescent treatment programs in the U.S. And that's how it started.
So you were lazy.
Very much so. But see, that's it.
That is so much. That is so much more than a lot of people would do. I mean, certainly there are people out in the world doing the work, doing the good. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
I mean, you have to recognize that there's an extra level that you've put in there.
You know, you called it. And laziness was my trend. That was my conditioning. The being the lazy Leo, being, you know, I expected the parade, but didn't expect to have to work for it. It was in 2009 that I confronted a final layer of laziness. Laziness will always be my dragon. Sloth is my original sin. And I am successful when I am not lazy. And the work of sobriety is every day. And the work of supporting families with my own podcast, with the parenting coaching that I do, with the app that I've put out and that we spent a fortune filming, with running a treatment facility, you can't be lazy and help families keep their kids alive. And so... Yeah. But every day is that battle, because I could be lazy today and go right back to the way it was. So today's the work.
Yeah. I mean, what else is there?
Right.
You know, it's funny too, because I just came out of Colorado pretty recently. And it was such a great dichotomy of things.
Yeah.
I came out of Denver and
beautiful town.
I came to Denver via a small town in Michigan. And so I was in Denver for almost a decade. And my whole situation changed. It was a geographical cure for me in a lot of ways. But there was one thing about specifically Denver, and I did see it in other cities in Colorado. People back home have all of this mental image of Colorado being a very weed-centered place.
Yeah.
But it is an alcohol-soaked place.
We have Coors Field.
Yeah. Yeah. There are breweries every other block.
Everywhere.
People drink and drive like it's nothing.
Yeah.
It's incredible the amount of drinking people do. It was something that for me was very strange because it taught me two things that were very important. One of the things it taught me that I didn't have a relationship with was I never really was that much of an alcohol person because the small town I came from, it was pretty economically depressed. And if you were drinking, you were drinking to get blackout hammered.
Right.
You were drinking to forget everything. There was nothing about just having a couple and going home. And I knew a lot of people that just weren't wired for it. My father was an alcoholic. I suppose I should say is. That's the correct terminology for it. But I always worried that I had that in me. And so I just kind of stayed away from it. Wasn't really my bag anyway, because I was a very active dude, wanted to always be doing things, and alcohol made me slow. And so I just kind of thought I'd rather be moving quickly, which was a whole other bucket of syrup. Right. But when I did discover that you could just have a couple of drinks and go home, that you could do things sort of socially and responsibly, that changed my relationship with alcohol. But that also opened a door, because once I could do just casual now and again, I developed a taste for it that I didn't have previously. And so I feel like I've been kind of walking this line where every few months or so, I've got to completely stop and just check myself to see where I'm at. Because I have this, I just have this fear that some of that alcoholism got in me.
Sure.
I still have that fear. And so I still check it every now and again to go, all right, can I live my life? Am I good? And the strange thing is I find that I'm usually pretty happy about it. After about a week giving it up, I get real busy. I find things to do. I pour myself into stuff. I find out that I had time I didn't know I had.
Yeah. And money.
And money. Oh, bars are not cheap.
No.
I also found out that there's a lot of other things you can do. You can spend your time with people. You can still go out. Talk to me a little bit about this idea of finding a positive aspect in what we might consider to be a bad behavior because it feeds something right. that you're missing.
I think first I want to say, and maybe this is controversial, I'm not the only one who believes this, but raising my children in Boulder, Colorado, growing up in Longmont, Colorado, having lived in Denver and Aurora and Lakewood, I love Colorado. Colorado is 300 days of blue sky and fentanyl use. Like you're right about the dichotomy. And as someone who has voted for the legalization and the decriminalization and recreation use of cannabis, I can also look at you and say, I was a cannabis addict. Now I'll get emails and letters that say cannabis isn't addictive. And my response is, I don't give a fuck. don't care whether it's addictive or not, because I know from working now 20 years with children and teenagers that razor blades are not addictive, but I have watched children act like junkies around using them to self-harm themselves.
Yes.
I know that a brick building with a bunch of stores in it is not addictive, but shopping is.
Yeah.
I'm an addict. And when I got sober, and this is where the answer to your question is coming from. When I got sober off of cannabis and then turned to alcohol, and then I stopped using alcohol and was involved in toxic relationships with women. And then after I said, whoa, you know, I'm codependent, and suddenly my eating issues developed. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point, about a year and a half into recovery, that I was like, oh shit, it's me. It's not cannabis. Let's stop pointing fingers and start looking in mirrors. I don't care. I don't care about the arguments. I understand brain chemistry in 20 years of running a treatment center where doctors and nurses and clinicians, master's level and above, and neuropsychologists have worked for me to teach these children what goes on in the brain with self-harm, with cannabis, with cocaine, with fentanyl. So I know what the science says, but I don't care. Now, what I have found when I hit that moment where I go, oh crap, it's me. It's not the alcohol. It's Aaron. And I stopped introducing myself at 12-step meetings like, my name is Aaron and I'm an addict. I would just say, I'm an addict and my problem is Aaron. And that reframing showed me that this wound became my way. This pain became my path. This tears became the trail. This wreckage became my resume. And I took something that was utterly destructive and I said, this is the gift that I have been given to understand this, to understand the insanity of stealing from your 2-year-old daughter so you could buy some weed.
Yeah.
Tell me weed's not addictive, because I acted like a junkie. So tell me it's not addictive. Convince me that I didn't have a problem, that it was all in my fucking head. I don't care what other people think about my addiction. I care what I think about it, because what I think about it keeps me sober every single day. People say, I got no regrets, no regrets. I have regrets. I regret who I was as a man, and that regret keeps me from being that man ever again. 2 days before my 23rd anniversary of sobriety, 2 days, I love the taste of beer. And so I buy non-alcoholic beer. And now microbrews are making non-alcoholics, and I love them. I love these rich things. Well, 2 days before, I sat down from a mix and match box that I had made at the liquor store, sat down, I cracked it open, ice cold, and that alcohol hit the back of my throat. And I looked down, and this was a 6.7 alcohol can. 23 years I've been sober. 2 days before my 23rd birthday, I took my first drink of alcohol. And I found myself standing over the sink, trying to decide whether or not I was going to shove my fingers down my throat to make myself puke it up. And the dragon showed up like it had never left. No, it's all right. Just finish the can. You're fine. You've already started. You're fine. It's been 23 years. I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah.
That's me. That's not the alcohol talking. That's Aaron talking. That's Aaron's voice.
Yes.
That's not alcohol's voice. So I dumped the rest of the can out and I sat down. So in 23 years, I've had one sip and it sent me to the sink with my fingers poised to gag. And so the work is as real today. And so here I am at 9:30 in the morning on Monday, October 18th, telling you that I'm sober. Yeah. Don't ask me about this afternoon until tomorrow, because I am not going to promise you this afternoon. I'll promise you this morning. It's one day at a time, every day. And that to me has kept me present in my life, present with my children, present with my business. That's the gift, is that I gotta be on.
This is a part of the conversation that people don't often have. And it's that people are not a statistic.
Right.
People are people. And there's your internal wiring versus the external forces. And yeah, you can absolutely say that cannabis is not addictive all that you want. Maybe it doesn't have certain enzymes and things like that in it so that it doesn't trigger the same way, say, nicotine does. But that's not the point. That's splitting hairs, because behaviors can be addictive.
Yep.
And if people are looking to a substance, to either erase or solve or enhance a situation in their life that they can't handle without it. Guess what? You got an addiction.
When Netflix has to ask you if you're still watching, tell me you're not caught in an addictive cycle. Look, addiction is I keep doing things to mess up my life and I can't stop. That's what addiction is. Addiction is conditioned use of maladaptive coping strategies. If you come home from a stressful, unbelievable stressful day at work, and the only way you can de-stress is a glass of wine and your favorite binging show.
Yes.
That's addiction. Yes. Can you do it without? Can you do it with healthy sleep, purposeful breathing, nutrition, movement, and water? Can you just keep, because binge watching TV and drinking a glass of wine every single night at 5 until your body goes, is it 5 yet? That's it. That's all you need to know.
Right.
You know, it's funny because when you're standing outside the 12-step rooms and everybody's saying, thank God I'm not high anymore. And they're right. And in one hand is a Monster and the other hand is a cigarette. And they've already had 2 donuts or cookies and a cup of coffee. Yeah. We're still dealing with people. That's not addictive. I don't give a crap whether it is anything. What are you until you do that work? This is where the success of our company came from. Is when we stopped looking at children and we stopped calling them addicts. But when a child says, I think I'm addicted to cutting, we said, does that help you to call yourself an addict? And they go, yeah, now I have form. It's like, okay, now we have concept. Now we can work with concept. Let's change concept. You know, and to then look at a family and say, my kid keeps, and as soon if they stop, I'll be happy. We'd be like, well, that's a lot of pressure on your child to keep the family happy. How about the family recovers and the child joins in the family recovery? How about the parents take charge and the parents take leadership in the home and the house again? My 14-year-old is running the house with their depression. Yes, they are, because the strongest nervous system wins. And I didn't say best, I didn't say healthiest, I said strongest. And a child who you just took the remote control from because they've played way too many video games, who starts screaming curse words and kicks a hole in the wall and threatens you, and you're like, where the hell? When parents say, are video games addictive? I say, well, if you took away their pills and they kicked a hole in the wall, would you be concerned? Oh yeah. It's like, then be concerned, because we're not dealing, I don't care whether video games are addictive. As much as I care that your child is acting like an addict.
There's so much listening that has to happen. And listening and belief. You know, when someone tells you that they're having an issue with something, the answer isn't to tell them that they're not.
It's just a cry for help. They're just looking for attention.
Yes,
they are.
To them.
They are. Are you listening? Are you giving them help? Are you paying attention?
Well, because there is that thing. There is that thing where you're putting yourself in a situation when you're even addicted to video games, right?
Right.
Something as simple as that. It's like if you require such a level of stimulation or escape or whatever reason you're there, there's a reason you're doing this instead of doing all of these other things that are going to help you, because this feels like it's helping you.
Your brain actually can't tell the difference. But look, the military did research on this. These soldiers out in the field who were in live firefights, they were measuring brain activity and saying, look at these parts of the brains that are stimulated. Then the soldiers would come back and relax by playing Call of Duty and other first-person shooters. The exact same parts of the brain were stimulated. The exact same parts of the brain were firing. They did the same with Olympic athletes, where they said, you know, go win a race and let's measure your brain chemistry when you win a race. And now sit in this chair and imagine you're winning a race. Guess what? Exact same parts of the brain being stimulated. So what if, just for the sake of argument, what if the brain doesn't know the difference between watching a dog being tortured on Facebook or YouTube and actually seeing it live? What if you're still traumatized? What if trauma is not something bad happened to me? What if it's something that happens to your body that your brain can't reconcile, or something happens to your brain that your body can't reconcile? What if we've tried to make it so complicated to experience explain to adults what's actually going on that now we're justifying non-action. Millennial dads are some of the best dads for the first time ever. I get more calls from millennial dads saying, I think my daughter's in trouble. Way before their daughter's in deep, deep, deep crisis. Gen X dads, boomer dads, they protect their daughters right into the casket.
Yeah.
You know, but now millennial dads who have more emotional intelligence are more sensitive to the emotions and feelings in the room are calling for intervention on themselves, not their kids. I get more calls from millennial dads and moms saying, I need to make some changes. Gen X moms still do great. Boomer moms and dads still need help. But the Gen X moms and the millennial moms and dads call up and say, something's going on and I need to make some changes. My kid's really struggling. What can I do differently? And I'm like, oh my God, that's it. That's it. Now we can lead the way to recovery.
Yeah. I mean, I saw the same thing in myself. I'm a Gen X dad. And my first few years as a father were repeating patterns that I had learned because this is how a dad acts.
Sure.
And my dad was doing the same thing. It was like, how do I be the best version of myself that I can be based on the information I have?
Right.
And you can only be the best version you can be based on the information you have. But if you're not interested in updating your information,
your system needs updated or it's just going to go offline or the upload and download speed's going to suck.
Yeah. I mean, imagine your emotional intelligence using the same processing power as, you know, a CRT monitor Tandy computer. I mean, it's like you just can't.
The old Commodore 64. That's what you're operating on, bud.
Yeah. You just can't do it. You're going to require some upgrades and you're going to be better for it. And that's one thing that I think that I have seen with a handful of people. The pandemic has been sort of, you know, a boon in that sense in some ways, because people have all of this time. And after you reach the end of the internet and you've seen all of the porn and you've gone through all of your phases of learning how to bake sourdough bread and you've done everything else, you're going to start reading some books eventually.
Yeah.
Some people will. And I know I did. I started reading some books. I started checking under the hood to see what's going on here and what can I change? Because something feels off, and I was assuming it was the world. But it's not the world necessarily. It's my reaction to the world. It's what am I doing in reaction to the information that I have? Right. What am I doing in reaction to the fear? Because there are different ways you can manage your fear. I'm not saying that you have to go out and start, you know, breathing on strangers, but the idea of getting out in the world and taking a walk, and if you're afraid of the idea that the air might be dangerous for you to breathe, find out.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing to ask of some people. I completely understand it. Information is conflicting. It's difficult. There's a lot of things, but I don't think that's an excuse not to try.
You've got to go back to the foundations of survival, right? If we let's say that the moment safety is threatened, which it has been, regardless of what you believe, you feel like your safety in the past coming on 2 years has been threatened.
Yeah.
That immediately kicks in your limbic system, your limbic brain, which was designed to keep you alive. It was designed to shut down all auxiliary power and operate only on primary thrusters, which are fight, flight, freeze, faint, fornicate, and feed. Those are the six things that a lizard does every day to survive. Fight, flight, freeze, faint, fornicate, feed. All right. So to understand that that is our immediate limbic response to our safety being threatened, to the fact that the world is divisive. Everybody thinks they're on the right side of history. I don't know if anybody is. Everybody's in the streets screaming about how everybody needs to clean up their yards when their own yards at home are full of weeds. Like we're just, this separation causes our pain. The love we withhold is the pain we carry. So that's my metaphysical explanation of what's taking place right now. So if we're going to become conscious about our survival state, we can either watch Preppers on YouTube and learn our outdoor survival and binge alone on Netflix, or we can then sit down with our prefrontal cortex, our human brain, not our lizard brain, but our human brain, and okay, I'm in a state of survival. What are the things that I need to do to survive? Here they are. You need to sleep a proper amount for you. Stop 8 hours. Oh no, millionaires do it in 4. Oh, bullshit.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, you're going to sleep as much as you need to sleep so that you feel healthy. Find out what that is and sleep that much. So healthy sleep. You need to drink water. I don't care how much soda you drink. If you don't double it with water, you're killing yourself. And you know this. Water is a foundation of our body's experience. You need to eat nutritious food. And nutritious food means you cook it. It's colorful. It feels good when you're done eating. Should you be keto? Should you be paleo? IDGAF. I don't give a... It doesn't matter what diet. It matters is, are you healthy? You need to move your body. What are they saying now? Sitting is the new smoking. That's why when I do podcasts, I stand up.
Yes.
Sitting is the new smoking. You need to move your body. And the final thing is, you need to breathe on purpose. You cannot accidentally survive a pandemic. You have to be conscious about what's going on. You cannot accidentally survive trauma. You cannot accidentally survive addiction. You cannot accidentally survive abuse. You cannot accidentally be a good parent or a successful entrepreneur. And those 5 things, sleeping, eating nutritious, body movement, drinking water, and breathing on purpose, are things you have to do to survive. So if you're in survival mode, go back to those 5 things. Simplify, 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 and focus on doing those 5 things on purpose. And your body will shift. If one of those things start to fall, they domino each other. You lose sleep, you're going to use a lot more coffee than actually eating food in the morning. And there goes your nutrition. When that happens, the water thing goes, because now you're dehydrated, et cetera, et cetera. So 5 things you do to kill the 6 survival strategies, which is fight, flight, freeze, faint, fornicate, feed. And you're doing those things accidentally. They're automatic behaviors that are behaviorally based, and it's a conditioned response that makes it worse.
You know, and you said something earlier too, that, and I've picked up a bunch of things from studying recovery over the years. And one of the things that I really, really love about it is that willingness to take things moment by moment, and have the grace to look at yourself and say, oh, I fucked up here. Now what? Let's go. Let's pick it up. Let's start over from right here.
Yeah.
No judgment. Let's just go. And that idea of taking those steps that you're talking about to taking care of yourself, if you fuck it up, you can get up and do it again in the next moment. You don't even have to wait for the next day. You can just pick your next moment and have that idea of, how do I want to feel after this? That's a question that I don't think people ask themselves very much. They ask themselves, you know, where do you want to be in 5 years? What are your plans? Things like that. All of that is great, but how do you want to feel at the end of the day? How do you want to feel at the end of the year? How do you want to feel at the end of your life? How do you want to feel? Those are questions that I've never asked myself until, quite honestly, pretty recently, just the past couple of years. It never occurred to me I could ask that.
I had a friend from acting school I spoke to. He's a lawyer. He's just a brilliant man out in Massachusetts. And when I was telling about what was going on with the insurance companies, shutting down my business, because who can afford $500,000 in property insurance when you're still a mom and pop shop? And by the way, a global pandemic and a 3,000% increase on my insurance premiums were not in my 5-year plan. So I did not see either of those coming, but I was asked, because, you know, I am a professional speaker. I speak all over the world. I can be very passionate about what I say. I can sound like an expert, and I can lecture doctors and scientists and win awards that they can't achieve, even though they're way smarter than me, because for me, people remember how I make them feel, not necessarily what I know. right? And that's just a gift of gab that I have always had in my life. So my lawyer friend asked me, he's like, well, you know, you could be the spokesperson to go lobby Congress and to go fight these insurance companies in public and to get the press and to send the passionate message for regulations on insurance companies. And he's right, because I possess that ability to command a stage and steal a microphone from somebody who does it for a living. It's just something I do well. But I had to sit back and say, if I die in 5 years, what do I want to have spent the previous 5 years doing? Knocking on doors in Congress to try to talk to people who don't want to listen, or help parents who do? I get that I could do other things, but what I'm here to do is to help families. And regardless of what the insurance company or the politicians and how they jump in the sack with each other and stroke each other's egos to the point of filling their pockets.
Yeah.
What hill am I going to die on? And right. That's where, it's not until you almost die that you realize what death is worth, what your life is worth, the value point. There have been two times in my life I've been very suicidal. One when I was a young kid, that first time. And I told you about that story about how Monty Python and laughing so hard, because that's what happened, is that I was a babysitter and I was gonna kill myself on a Saturday. And every Friday night I babysat. And I was gonna go say goodbye to these kids for the last time. I really love these kids. And I was gonna kill myself on Saturday. And I had my plan. I was going to use a knife. And before I left for my Friday night babysitting, my friend Neil Baker called me and said, are you babysitting tonight? I said, yeah. And he goes, you got to watch PBS at 10 o'clock, Channel 6, which is PBS in Colorado. And I said, okay. I didn't tell him I was leaving on Saturday, but I put the kids to bed that night. 10 o'clock came around and I turned on Channel 6 and Monty Python's Flying Circus came on. And it was the Twit of the Year episode. Yes. And I laughed so hard I broke. I said, I'll give it one more week. I'll watch another episode next week. And Monty Python kept me alive from Friday to Friday for a summer. And that was enough to keep me going. The second time I was suicidal was in 2018. Everything was going great. I not only was our business making just wonderful, wonderful changes in the world. We were an effective, impactful business. We were financially secure as a business and therefore as a couple. And I had a side gig and I was speaking all over the world. And my kids were both going to college and graduating, and you know, they were living their lives. My wife's and my relationship was phenomenal, and I went through my midlife crisis. And I had always thought that's just a bad attitude for men. And after all these years of working with kids with depression and adults with depression, here I was suffering in silence for a year as a man, and I could not comprehend telling anybody. I could not bring anybody to where I was. And that suffering in silence, despite the support that I had. Finally, I was in Amsterdam and we're in a $450 a night hotel in dead downtown Amsterdam. I had a conference room full of people downstairs waiting on me to talk and teach them how to run their businesses and be successful and personal empowerment. And I'm sobbing on my bed in front of my wife, telling her what it's been like to be ready to die for a year. When you hit these points in your life, you remember or you learn what hill you're here to die on. Yeah. And that to me is the key to life. If I'm ready to kill and I'm ready to die for something that I so truly love, could I live for it? Could I work hard for it? Could I get up early and stay up late to make sure it gets accomplished? Because if I'm willing to kill for my children and never apologize in defense of their life and limb, if I'm willing to die for my children and never regret because I'm in defense of their life and limb, am I willing to leave a legacy? Am I willing to be financially free? Am I willing to show them how to be a good man or to fall in love with a good man or to work for a business or to pay your taxes on time or whatever? Because all those things, when life and death is on the line, everything else becomes, yeah, I could do that.
Yeah. that idea of the opposite of the question of what are you willing to die for?
Yeah.
What are you willing to live for?
Yeah.
That's incredibly powerful because it requires you to think about very different things and it requires a lot more work. But if it is something that you truly love and truly feel passionate about, you'll get it done. I mean, people with children know this because there are so many times that children will drive you to the brink of your sanity. And yet there's nothing you wouldn't do for your children. You know, you hear those stories about people overcoming insurmountable odds to lift a car off of a
right,
child. You know,
right.
There's something in us where we have the ability to drive ourselves beyond our capability into some kind of next level in certain circumstances, but we also have the ability to create those circumstances.
When you really start to study, because I can hear our conversation right now start to cause shame and anxiety in someone who's dealing with depression and suicidality, right? And this us being sensitive to this part of the conversation is the key to teaching people about suicide and depression, is that depression is not an attitude. Right? My midlife crisis was not a bad attitude. Your suicidal ideation as a youth was not a bad attitude. Depression is a description of brain chemistry. Your brain function is depressed. So to look at your kids, and that's the experience I got in midlife crisis, is I look at this wife and this marriage that I'm in utter adoration of, and my kids who are doing so well and we're connected and I have relationships with them, a job I love, a side gig that just lights me up, and still I was ready to die. And I could, in that space, I could not comprehend having a bad marriage and having a shitty job and having kids who didn't respect me, because I know I'd eaten a bullet if that was the case. What was keeping me alive was all these external things that I loved, but I was still so ready to die. And that's depression, is because the brain chemistry isn't working. It wasn't a bad attitude I had. It was the fact that my brain was not letting blood flow to those pleasure centers because it was on auxiliary power only.
Yes.
It had cut off my desire to shower. It had cut off my desire to eat. It had cut off my desire to connect. It had cut off my desire to do anything except hold sacred the little amount of energy that it could produce to keep me breathing. And so to look at someone and say, but don't you love your kids? Don't you love your wife? The fucking course someone with depression. You can go downstairs for Christmas morning and open presents and laugh and connect with your family and be depressed. Your parents can throw you a birthday party and invite all your best friends, and you can have a slumber party where you laugh so hard you cry and be depressed.
Yeah.
Like, that's depression. Anxiety, when you have anxiety to the point of dysfunction, that's because your amygdala is malfunctioning, not because you're nervous and can't face the music, and, oh, these Gen Zers are just not as resilient. ER, fuck off with that. Your amygdala is setting off an alarm going bam, 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 because something in your future trip of going to school, going to the mall, going sailing, going to meet your girlfriend, something in your vision of the future has triggered a trauma. Something in the picture of the future reminds you a picture of your pain. And your body is going, nope, avoid it at all costs. And you don't get to shut it off, especially if you don't know what the picture is, especially if you don't know what the trigger is. And that's why therapy. Yeah. So we cannot look at depression and anxiety and call it an excuse to not go to school. Shame on you for doing that. And when they get suicidal because of either of those, to say they're just seeking attention. You're damn right they are. Give it to them.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why things like sleep, water, diet are so important, because if your body is already functioning at an auxiliary level, you've got to be doing the best thing you can for it. And those things might actually save your life, because it might not take away your depression, but it might put you just above the waterline enough that you can breathe through it.
When parents come to me and their kids are really dealing with a lot of depression, anxiety as well, but mostly depression, and they're ready for treatment, I do have them look at wilderness programs. Not because wilderness programs have great therapy. They have okay therapeutic intervention. What they have is body intervention. Because when you're hiking 8 miles a day, your brain starts pumping out dopamine. And your brain's cutting off of dopamine is a side effect of depression. So just the kids being in the wilderness for 45 to 65 days, hiking every single day, breathing fresh air, breathing hard, earning that meal and earning that sleep and getting their sleep patterns back on track, literally combats the depression. Should you also use meds? Oh, hell yeah. Pills and skills, baby. Get both going. Figure it out. But that's why I suggest wilderness often for kids who are dealing with depression, because it kicks their brain chemistry into play.
Yeah. I mean, and if your brain ain't making the right chemicals, store-bought is just fine.
Right. Right. It's not going to fix it, but it is going to help you get through it.
Right. And that's really all it's about sometimes, because the fact of the matter is, if you've got some wiring in there, you may be able to unwire it. Sure. But maybe you can't. It's ridiculous to think that coping mechanisms and therapy and all of those things are going to be the thing that completely rewires you and changes you so that you're not even the same person anymore. The goal isn't to be a different person.
Right.
The goal is to be the version that you are and alive and able to handle the things that come at you more often than not. And when you can't handle them very well, all you got to do is stay alive through it. It's one day at a time, literally. We're just going to take this one thing at a time. And yeah, getting outside and breathing some air and picking some small activities and being able to tell yourself, I can do this. Your brain does not know the difference between accomplishing the task of climbing Mount Everest and making your fucking bed in the morning. it's going to deliver you a little dopamine spike every time you tell it, I've completed a task.
We call that the one thing strategy in therapeutic. It's like, do one thing. I don't care how small it is. Well, okay, today I'll drink a glass of water. Great. You can go back to bed after that.
Yeah.
But now today you've done one thing. I cleared off my desk. Great. Your desk is clear. The other thing is that after we have this conversation, then I hear parents say, well, I can't get my kid to go volunteer at the Humane Society, climb Mount Everest, or make their bed. You know, what do I do? And I was like, I was never talking about your kid with depression. I was talking about you as a parent. Because with you, when your kid hasn't gone to school in 3 months because of their depression, guess what? You're depressed now too. Your family is dealing with depression, not your child. Your family has Alzheimer's, not your grandma. Your family is in recovery, not stepdad who's been drinking too much. Everybody does the work, not this child. The moment we say, well, if only this child could deal with their depression, then the family would be happy. No, 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 no. Nobody's happy. Everybody's got depression. The child is just expressing the language of the family through their behavior. Everybody goes into recovery. Yes, the two-year-old. Yes, stepdad who thinks that this is bio dad's problem. Everybody goes into recovery. And you lead the way in recovery. You don't tell the kid to take the helm. Well, you've got to go volunteer at the Humane Society. You have to exercise. We all know this to be true. Show them how. Because we don't learn from our parents' lectures. We learn from our parents' modeling.
Yes. I could talk to you about all of this for 4 hours. but I want to ask you a couple of things as we're winding down here. And I want to know, because you're in a pretty different situation than you were 18 days ago. So let me ask you this, as far as resources and as far as the things that you've still got available, I know that you've still got the website.
Yeah.
Is the app still up and running?
The app will forever be up and running because the app is everything I have ever taught parents, whether their kids were in deep crisis, just displaying at-risk behaviors, or actually doing okay. You just know they could do great. So it's good. You just go to Brab app, B-R-A-B app, app.com, brabapp.com. And right now it's $37 for 56 parenting classes, and it's extremely high quality filming. And I kept at this price because I want to help parents. That was the point of the work in the beginning. So if I can't do it residentially, then I will do it through this app, and hopefully it will scale and parents will just help parents find the app and get the help. You take a little quiz at the beginning to figure out, should you start in the red, the yellow, and the green, but you get all three courses for that $37. And so that's the first thing. And that's my paid one, right? That's my paid. So that's my ask. Everything else I do is free. On Monday nights, I do a free call available to anybody at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. And to get that link, you've got to be on my free Facebook page called Parenting Teens That Struggle. And it's a group that's moderated by me and overseen by other therapists and my daughter, who's a part of that community. And then I have my podcast, Beyond Risk and Back. And that's, I release shows every Friday, and you can find the shows anywhere you get your podcast, or you can find it on Parenting Teens That Struggle, the private group on Facebook. So yeah, it's just a matter of how many parents can I reach? And of course I see individual clients, both teens and parents, but that's something we can look into later. But right now, go get free support. The podcast, the Facebook group, and then the coaching is very, very affordable. It's a week's worth of coffee.
Yeah. I cannot thank you enough for the amazing conversations, your incredible, unique point of view. I love everything about what you're doing. I think it's so important. I think it's so necessary. And I'm just really, really glad that you talked to me today.
Chris, thanks for the opportunity just to talk with you again. Your show's coming out, and on Beyond Risk and Back, your story was unbelievably inspiring, and I think will really help parents understand from your personal experience what their kids are going through. So again, right back at you. It's an easy conversation to have with you. You're amazing.
And there you have it. Aaron Huey, ladies and gentlemen. He is... man, such an inspiration. I absolutely love everything that this dude does. And if you love everything that this dude just did and you want to get some more, and I know that you do, go to the Beyond Risk and Back podcast. You can find it everywhere podcasts are found. It's the number one parenting podcast. You will absolutely love it. You can also go to firemountainprograms.com if you are interested in seeing what else he's got going on. There is a Beyond Risk and Back app as well, which is out there, that you can check that out and you can get that. And as for me, I'm on Patreon, I'm on Instagram, I'm everywhere you can find Coffee Over Suicide. But until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.